Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy, and welcome to episode 2 of the Admin Admin Podcast. Thanks everyone for listening and downloading to episode 1. I hope you're going to enjoy this whole series of podcasts that we're going to do. Now, the last one we were talking about was about troubleshooting. But this one we're going to go into something completely different. Now, before we go on, have you been up to anything this week or today, or any interesting jobs you've come across?
Yeah, well, I picked up a project because we had a guy leave from work and I got dumped at the wrong end of the installation. It was a migration from they're currently running Exchange 2003 email server. They've got about 3 servers doing all the different mailbox roles. They've got one server just doing the public folders, and then they've got one server doing the front end webmail, which is kind of presented out onto the internet. But it's been set up really oddly in the past. It's really odd. So we're trying to, because obviously Exchange 2003 and Windows Server 2003 is end of life next year, we're migrating them to Exchange 2010, because you can't go directly from Exchange 2010 to 2013. You have to go from Exchange 2003 either to 2007 or then to 2010 and 2013. So these people have got like 500 mailboxes they need to migrate, but they wanted to make it highly available. So they've got 2 sites. So on the first site, they have 2 mailbox servers, 2 mailbox roles, and those mailboxes are then replicated to an off-site, which is their backup DC. And what can happen is that if one of the Exchange servers dies, it basically replicates, it can fail over, which is quite cool. So we have it so that you've got the 2 mailbox servers, and you use a thing called DAG groups, which is database availability groups, and you set it up so that we manually load balance it. So we put one mailbox on one server and then one mailbox on the other server, so that you have 50-50 load on that server, so that if we lose one Exchange server, that it will fail over to the backup server. And then if we use a complete site, then they both fail over to the backup Exchange server. And it's quite clever because you have a thing in front of it called a CAS array, which is basically where your Outlooks connect to, or if you're using AWA, your mobile phones to, that's where they connect to. And if the mailbox server fails, or one of those servers fails, or if the site fails, what happens then is that they automatically get redirected, so which is quite clever. But what the guy before me hadn't configured is that the guy phoned up saying that about 1 in 3 emails weren't getting sent out onto the internet. So what it boiled down to was that he'd configured the 2 servers, which were the front end servers, could send emails out automatically, but and on the firewall rules they were allowed to be sent out, could send mail out, but no one had thought about the third server on the backup site. I haven't looked into this much, but you had to configure the firewall rules on the third server. So I'm guessing if you did lose the 2 sites, you want the third server to send emails out. So that's what I've been playing with today.
Right. I mean, that sounds like that's a good project. You know, it's got going to be several stages to it as well, isn't there? Would you have to go So you're going from 03 to
2010.
And then you can go to the new one from that.
Yeah, you have to, when you get everyone on 2010, you then have to remove the last Exchange 2003 server, because you can't introduce a 2013 server into the into the organisation with a 2003 still in it.
Okay, so you're going to have to make sure everything is transferred, everything is
yes.
up and running, going. So what kind of time scale would you put on that? You know, if you did it all in what, if you did the first step in one go, how long would that take with that many mailboxes? And then how long would you leave it to make sure everything's working before you go on to 13?
Yeah, well, we've quoted 15 days, I think, to do the complete migration, but it doesn't take too long to install if you do your research first and make sure that the existing exchange is healthy and you understand how it works. So it took me a couple of days. Well, it didn't take me, the guy did. It took a couple of days to install it, and then a couple of days then reconfigure it and testing it all, because all this high availability stuff is quite hard. You need to test it out, because you don't want to put it all in, meet all everybody across, and then test it, because that's the last thing you want to do, because it probably find out it doesn't work, which we did have a load of issues with, that we brought the wrong certificate, so we had to purchase the correct certificate. It didn't have the right names in it. So the problem you've got is, and then you have to move all the mailboxes, but we then leave that for the client to do, to move them across, because you have to use it with the, talk to the end users to obviously decide when to move the mail across. Because what will happen is that you can move mailboxes in, but when you move them across, so when you migrate them from Exchange 2003 to 2010, they have to come out of Outlook for it to work. So what we normally do is do it in the evening. So we close the Outlook, we get everyone to close the Outlook, and then in the evening we just move certain mailboxes at night time. Because if you're going from 2010 to 2013, people can actually stay in their mailboxes all the time. But what happens is when they're gone, gets to the, when it finishes coming to migrate it from the 2010-2013 server, it will pop up a little box saying that you need to restart Outlook. And when you restart Outlook, it basically locks the mailbox for a second and then finally migrates over to the new server.
Okay, so do you have to take the OST files off the workstations?
It does it all in the background for you. So all it does is just repoints you to the new Exchange server. I definitely, it's going to be another podcast, because there's been quite a lot of them I'm going to have to be doing. So it's kind of I'm guessing people would be quite interested in that.
Yeah, Exchange and how it works and the different versions of it that we have at the minute, because we've still got 03, you know, and there's several ones since then as well. So we'll do that on a different show, definitely. On the other side, I haven't really done that many interesting things this week. It's been plenty of stuff to do, just not really that interesting. A couple of rebuilds, reinstalls, and a few new machines that I've set up. Most interesting one, I suppose, I've been doing is a CCTV one. Where some cameras are coming back and recording onto a DVR box. But what they want to be able to do with that DVR is view them on the PCs within the network and at home as well. So that's one thing I've been working on this week. We're just waiting for a new DVR box to come in, and then we'll be able to carry on setting that up. So that can probably be another story on the next podcast, maybe.
All right. So, have you had to open port forward anything on the firewall or the router they've got so it goes out on the internet at all?
That's right, yes. It's got to have, we basically use a DDNS. I think they used noip.net, I think it was.
Is it .org?
It's one of them. I think it's .org or .net. No IP. It's similar to dyn.com. Similar way to the way that works. But basically just port forward in it. I think it uses port 8080. So just the normal web port. And then just port forward that to the local IP address. The problem we've got with the system at the minute is the actual DVR box is knackered. So we're just waiting for a new one to come in, and then we'll have to set that up hopefully exactly the same as what the old one was. So that should be coming in this week, so fingers crossed on that. We should be able to carry on with that a bit later on.
All right. But so do you have to? Yeah. Do you have to pay for the dynamic DNS then, or is that free? I can't.
Some of them, such as Dyn.com, has recently gone to all paid. They used to have one where you could have, it was very limited, but maybe two addresses or maybe five addresses, I think it was, you could have it for free. And any more than that, you had to pay a very small amount per year. But Dyn.com's gone to fully paid now. But there are a few of them that are free. I think No IP is free, and there's a few others as well. It's a good service. Even the Dyn.com, I've used them before with some other clients, and it is a good, reliable service that they do. So it basically just gives you an address, which you can type into your browser from any PC in the world, and it takes you to. First of all, it finds your router, and then the port forwarding within the router sends you to your DVR box, and then there's a little web browser within the DVR box, so you can look at the cameras. Mm-hmm. So you can see the cameras. The place I'm working for is an industrial estate, and they've got security cameras over the car park and looking at the front views of all the businesses there. So it's mainly for, you know, the cameras are mainly there for theft and stuff like that. Okay. Initially they had a break-in and they had no cameras up. So this is why they got it in the first place. And say one of the business owners was at home at 10 o'clock at night, they could look live onto the front of their business while he's sat at home, and even on the mobile phones as well, because you can get apps for your mobile phone, so you can look at it on your mobile. And even while you're remote, even while you're at home, you can go back to an earlier part of the day. You could go an hour back or a day back if you wanted, and see what happened the day before, or remotely. Ultimately, of course, you can take a section of video off, save it as an AVI file, and that kind of evidence can be given to the police and things like that, you know, if anything was stolen. So it's a really good system. I actually like how it works. If it hadn't broken, it would have been great. So once we get this replacement box, it should all be good again. So anyway, on with tonight's topic. So tonight's topic's all about IP addresses, but specifically DHCP. So why don't you go ahead and explain what DHCP is, what it stands for, what it does, and why we all need it, and why we need to know about it.
Right, okay. So DHCP stands for Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. So why do we need it? Well, I was thinking everyone uses it at home on their home network normally, or then. So, as you know, you need an IP address. We're not going to go into that much this week. Probably be another podcast for that. Is that everyone has to work on the network? You need to have an IP address to communicate with any other devices on the network, or if you want to go on the internet. So, for a computer to talk to another computer, they have to have an IP address. First of all, they have to be on the same subnet range, and they mustn't be the same one. So you could also go around and configure an IP address manually on each of those machines, but that can be quite annoying because you'd have to work out if you've got a Mac, or if you're on your phone, you have to set it manually. That's a bit annoying. So you've got a thing called DHCP. What that does is that automatically configures your device, any device on the network, with a set IP address. So what happens is when a device boots up on your network, so let's say you've got home, you plug your PC into the network, your laptop in the network, it hasn't got an IP address. So what happens is it sends a request out onto the network, which is called a DHCP discover. So you normally on there, you basically do a broadcast request saying, is there any DHCP servers out there? And if you've got one, normally at home, it's your router or your, and that will then come back with a DHCP offer saying, yes, I'm a DHCP server. Then what happens is that will then say, the device will say, yep, I would like an IP address. And what will then happen is that the DHCP server will then give that PC or that device an IP address. And then it will send an acknowledgement back to the router saying I've got an IP address. So it doesn't always gives you an IP address. It gives you a number of things. Normally what it does, it gives you your IP address, your subnet mask, and your default gateway. And also normally gives you a couple of DNS servers so that you can get out onto the internet so you can do your DNS request lookup. So there are normally different options it gives you. And then what happens then is that you can, that's what I think, is that, yeah, so it gives you a DHCP address, and that what that does, so on your DHCP server you normally have a scope of what IP addresses that gives out. So normally on your home IP address range you get like in the 192.168.0 network. So you've got one, which is normally your default gateway, which is your router. And then let's say your Netgear router will then give you out 2 to 100 as IP addresses. What does, when you get your 2, it puts it in this little database that it's already got 2 given out. So when if you plug another device into the network, it comes along and gives out .3 because it knows that .2 has already been taken. And again, so is that number 4. When the third device comes on, it'll give it .4. So that's basically what a DHCP server is. It basically gives all your devices on the network IP addresses so that it can speak to the outside world or speak to all the devices internally.
So it also makes sure that every device has a different number, a different address.
Yeah, unique IP, yeah.
Yeah, so once one's registered, say number 2, so nothing's onto the network at this point, for example. The router's switched on. The router gives itself number 1, which is already set to be number 1, and there's nothing else plugged into the network at all. The first PC boots up, asks for a IP address, and the router says, well, the first one on my list available is number 2. Then it gets given the number 2. Now, what happens, say another one boots up and that gives given the number 3. And say you shut down the first computer again, which has got number 2. As soon as that PC switches off, does that number 2 address all of a sudden become available again? Will the next one that's been the next number given out by the DHCP server, will that be number 2 or will that be number 4?
It all depends on what the configuration is. On a little normal little D-Link router or Belkin, I can't remember, I think it gives it back. It sends, if you do it properly, if you shut down the machine, it should send a command back to the router saying, yep, you can give this IP address out, you can give this IP address back. You've got a thing also called
I was thinking about the lease time. Where does that come into it? And is the lease time run by the DHCP server?
Yes.
Okay.
So normally that it's set for 24 hours or whatever. So what happens is that after 24 hours, if that hasn't heard anything back from that PC, it will go and clear that out, and then someone else can use it. So what happens is if your lease is 24 hours, okay, what should happen is that halfway in that time, so 12 hours through, your PC should go back to DHCP server and saying, yep, I've still got this IP address, and then it will renew it for another 24 hours.
Okay, I was not how it works. So 12 yes. hours, it gets another 24, and then 12 hours yep. later, it gets another 24.
Yeah.
But what happens? So if after 12 hours, it's switched off, then the original 24-hour lease ends.
Yeah. And then gives it back out.
And then all of a sudden, then number two is available for the next device that comes along. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I should have researched that a bit more about the what happens if I think there is a command where it goes and says, "Yep, I'm finished with the IP address now," and they make it available for someone else. Depending if the machine's shut down cleanly or not, is because it might be just pulled off the network or put into hibernation mode. It might not get time for it to send that command back.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. Now I've got a bit of a side question here. And the answer might be a big answer, and we can go into it a different podcast. But what is a subnet?
What is a subnet? That's a good question. We could have a whole episode
of
that.
Yeah, we could, yeah. but, okay, what is a subnet mask, for example?
All right.
So, I mean, most of the time you get a subnet mask, and I can probably bet if I look on this machine here, it's 255.255.255.0. Okay. I could probably guess. And I'm going to have a look.
Yeah.
And it probably will. And it is. Okay. So you also see subnet mask, which could be slightly different. 255.255. I think I've seen 225.0 as well. So if you've got a different subnet mask, what does that mean to the network? And is that controlled by the DHCP server?
Yeah, well, DHCP server defines what the subnet mask is going to be. So basically, a subnet mask tells you if that IP address is on that local subnet or not. So to tell it to forward your request to the IP gateway of that network. So, like, you know, if you got 192.168.0.1, as the region .2 is your PC, and it's got a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0, which is also called /24, and you wanted to get out onto an IP address, say you're going, you kind of get to the Google DNS 8.8.8.8.8, mm-hmm. What that subnet mask is, it tells you, is that IP address 8.8.8.8, is that on the same subnet as the 192.168.0? And there's a calculation what happened in the background, because all those actual numbers, the four numbers of between the dots, so that what that number of IP address between the zero can be, a number can be 0 to 225, and what that actually gets converted into is a binary address. And it matches it up, and it's quite complicated to explain without drawing it on a bit of paper, and then hard to explain just over the microphone. Is that it, obviously, to see that you can tell, you like looking at 192.168 is not 192.168.0 is not on the same subnet as 8.8.8.8, because obviously the numbers are different.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's a different. It's a 32-bit binary number, isn't it?
Yes.
That is. Yeah. Yeah.
So, if it wanted to speak to a device on 192.168.0.3, let's say, it would know that use a subnet mask. It would know that those two IP addresses are on the same subnet, so it wouldn't have to route the information through the IP gateway. But because obviously you know that 8.8.8 is on a separate. Is on a different subnet than 192.168.0.
Yeah, it's
that's
not,
what a subnet mask.
Google doesn't exist inside your little network at home.
Yeah.
Google's somewhere else. So, yeah.
But like you're saying, you can have a bigger IP address like 255.255.255.240, let's say, which is a /28. It means you can only have 18 IP addresses in that subnet. So you would probably see that if you've got given up a load of IP addresses from your ISP. So they're routable IP addresses normally. So it's just a way of showing the IP addresses out.
a shared one. I see, yeah, that's right.
So it's quite complicated. So I'll probably do a whole show on that, starting from the beginning.
On a subnet, yeah, I thought it would be. Yeah. It's in basic terms, it's not too bad, but once you go into it, it's quite complex, isn't it? Now, yeah. Going on to a different, this is something that I've come across in the past, is when you're on a system, on a network, and you have a situation where IP addresses are coming, I've had it before where they seem to be coming out of nowhere, and you're wondering, where on earth are these devices getting IP addresses from? Mm-hmm. And turned out to be another device which someone else had plugged in to the system. I think another router, for example, which also had a DHCP server on it, apart from the original one. So, is this what you call a rogue DHCP server, isn't it? And if you did introduce two DHCP servers onto one network, what problems would you have? Could you do it deliberately for any particular tasks, or would it cause too many hassles?
Yeah, you can do. With a rogue DHCP server, it's like you maybe have, like, say, someone buys a access point from PC World, which is actually a router built in, so it's not actually a wireless access point, it's actually a router as well. And there's a thing they're going to use at the wireless access point, you're going to get that dishing out IP addresses as well as your normal default gateway. So what you're going to get is that you could have it that they're issuing IP addresses, and because they're both on the same network, they would just fight. So whoever sends a request out, it will say, can I have a DHCP address? Whichever one comes back first, whichever one device comes back first, you will get will give out an IP address. So you could have a device which is giving out 192.168.0, which is the correct one, but you might have, so you say, like, another one which is one giving out a 192.168.1 address. We had this the other month back where we had PC getting a really odd address. It was like a 172.16.10 address or something, and they phoned up saying, well, some half the PCs on the network were getting different IP addresses, or they were saying we couldn't get out on the internet. So did a bit of troubleshooting, got the user to do a IP config and actually look at it to see what the actual IP address was set to, and it was set to a 172.16 address when they were, should have been a 192 address. And I'm going, this is a bit odd. And I'm going to the people, you haven't plugged in any routers or anything in. And he goes, no, there's nothing there at all. This is a bit odd. So I basically, you can look at, when you look at the IP address, it basically looks up at the, what it if you do an IP config /all, it will tell you what the DHCP server IP address is. It will tell you where it's got its IP address. So I thought, this is a bit odd. So I'm thinking, why? Where's his 10 or his 172 address coming from? And I'm going, hang on a minute. So I did a look at it, and I tried to ping it, and I couldn't ping it, and again, this is odd. So I looked at the MAC address of it. So I looked at, I did an R-A, which basically you can run from the command, and it basically it gives you a list of IP addresses and what the MAC address is. And I was looking at this MAC address. So I, do you know what MAC address is? If you look at the first eight numbers, or the eight addresses of it, if you Google that, it tells you what device it is, because, like, they're defined, the first 16 addresses. If you Google it, it will tell you, like, who manufactures it.
That's right, yeah, the first bit is, that's, I seem to remember, is that just the manufacturer, is it, the first?
So, yeah, the first 16, because it's a 32-bit right. address, isn't it? So the first 16 is the is a manufacturer, and all, because as I said before, most of the kit we sell is HP. And I'm going, hang on a minute, this is coming back with a Dell address. Why is it a Dell address? And so, I'm going, so have you got anyone?
The MAC address of it was a Dell address then.
Yes.
Of that, so it was getting an IP address from a MAC address, which was a Dell device, And you knew for a fact that there wasn't any Dell devices on the network.
No, because all we sell is HP kit. And I'm going, have you got anyone on site? And they go, I don't. Hang on. She goes, hang on a minute. We've got some SAP consultant in the corner. And he was a SAP consultant doing their ERP system. And he had a virtual lab on his, like a virtual machine, doing some testing in it. And this was dishing out IP addresses. So it'd been on the network all for like 2 days. And obviously when the lease had come up to expire, people were getting new addresses from this DHCP server. So it's very hard to stop these things unless you've got a really high-end switch, because the way it will look at it is that it will drop the packets. So when a DHCP server responds, it's on a certain port, you can get the switch or a router can block that. But only on high-end devices you get it. You wouldn't get it on your, even on a cheap or on a layer 2 managed switch. It's very hard to stop 2 DHCP servers.
So you can get these DHCP servers on many different devices, can't you? They generally, you'll always have it on a router. Now a Windows server, it can be a DHCP device as well, and high-end switches as well. And sometimes, like that guy who had that program running on his laptop, that can do it as well.
Because like VirtualBox is like, if you've got it, you can set it up as a bridge network, and it basically bridged his network onto his machine, and that machine had a DHCP server on it. It was classing it. So you basically can get DHCP server on your router. So on your router you get at home, whatever, your Belkin or whatever, there's not much you can do on it. You can get your Cisco routers and your HP switches can do all your DHCP server, so your DHCP server options as well. But obviously the problem with that is that you have to go in there and do your command line. I like to do all my DHCP servers from my Windows server, because you can stop people actually, if you've got a domain, you have to be a domain admin to actually activate a domain control, sorry, a DHCP server.
Okay.
So when you install the role, you actually have to activate it, and it actually goes off and checks that person actually has the permissions to set up a DHCP server on that range. So on the DHCP server, you can set up so many different things. You've got a systems thing, which is you set up a thing called a scope. So a scope is what is the subnet of what you've got. So on my little home network, my scope is 192.168.0.0. Okay. And the first thing you do is you have to set up address pool. So this is basically where you're setting what addresses are being allowed to be distributed. So normally on my addresses, I set 100 to 200 as the IP addresses which you're allowed to distribute. Okay. And then you can have to set up different scope options for things, which are basically things are set when it asks for IP addresses. So my scopes options are, you get given a 003, which is the router address, and that's given 192.168.0.1. okay. Also gives out the DNS server, which is 006 option, which mine's giving 192.168.0.10, which is my local server at home. And also you can define things like, because this is a Windows server, because if you've got a domain, obviously you want that PC to be on there, you need to set the DNS domain name, which is 015, okay, and that setup, that gives the DNS name for that machine, and that tells you what the domain name, my one's chrisman.local on there. So that gives you what that little local IP address is, so the local DNS name, so that it can register itself in DNS. You've got other options, like you've got 066, which is basically an option if you've got things like IP phones on your network. Okay, when you boot that up, it will tell it where your phone system is. So I'm running a couple of little VoIP phones home, and mine's set to 192.168.0.8, so that when that phone boots up, it tells you how to get to the phone server. So there's so many different things you can set. up, like, I know you can set up things like you can set the NTP server, what you can do things like as well, like we're doing a thing at like a project at work where when you boot your machines up, it will go and do a pixie boot so that it will go up and boot up. So if you haven't got an image on your machine at all, like a Windows image or OS on your machine, it will boot up and it will tell you where your boot server is, so that it will go along and pick up your image so it can download and put the little your image on it. So there's so many different things you can do. What we haven't talked about yet is that you can set reservations. Say you've got a photocopier, okay, and you want that to be, or a printer, you want that to be the same IP address every single time. Because if you've got TCP/IP printing set up, you don't want that to change. So what you can do is you can set a reservation up. So you need to know what the MAC address of what the actual device is, which I'm guessing you can get off the device. Or what I normally do is let the device get an IP address, and then inside the DHCP screen on Windows 2000 in the Windows server, it gives you a list of all the machines, and it tells you what the IP address, what the name is, and it also gives you the MAC address under the unique ID. And what you can do is you can set up a reservation on that, and what that does is that you basically tell it what the MAC address of the device is and what the IP address is. So every time that machine asks for an IP address, when it asks for an IP address, it will get given the same IP address.
I can see how that's very, very useful, isn't it? Especially for a printer, a scanner, you know, something like that. Because if it's got the same address every time, then there's nothing going to change. Is that, you know, if you've got a printer set up on a workstation to print to 1.100, for example, and then next week it gets given another number, then everyone's printing is going to stop, isn't it? No one's going to be able to print anymore. So by reserving that, it makes life a bit easier. Now, there's something slightly different here. And now, what is the difference between reserving an IP address and going to the local workstation and specifying a static IP address? What's the difference between... I mean, they both give the same number every time, but why would you do each one differently, and what advantages does each one have?
Yes, some photocopier engineers don't like setting it with DHCP, so they like to give it a manual address. So you can either give it a manual address outside the scope, so there, if you've got 100 to 200, I normally like to give printers .50 addresses, so you can... Obviously, you wouldn't need to set a reservation for that. But what you can do is, say if you wanted it in between that 100 and 200 devices, what you can do is you can... It doesn't really matter. You can give it a reservation, because whatever that is, that device is always going to have it, and it means it won't give it out to anyone else. But you can also give it an exclusion. So you can add an IP address you want to exclude it. So that you could say, like, give it to .150... So that wouldn't ever get given out, but you wouldn't see it in your address list. The way I like to do it is give it as a reservation and give it, because then you can see it in the list. So in your if you go to your Windows server and you look at DHCP option, you can click on address leases and it will show you all the machines on the network and who's got that IP address, how long the lease expired. And you can see by looking at that what devices you've got on network, and you can see that it will give you a little... zero, it's got like a little eye against it, zero, a little blue eye, and that'll tell you it's got reservation on it, and that means that you can easily see what that IP address of that device is. If you give it an exclusion, you won't see it in the address leases.
If you go, right, and it's a lot easier if you can see it in that list, isn't it?
Now,
I've also used another program called it's just called NetScan. It's a portable program you can run off your pen drive.
Yeah,
which you can run off any PC, I would guess, on the network. I think it's made by SoftPerfect. I think you can... well, that's where you can download it from anywhere. There's a 32-bit version and a 64-bit version, and that basically just scans the network. It gives you the option of what IP range do you want to scan on. So you could say 192.168.0.1 up to .254, and then it will go and look for every device and see how many devices are connected, what IP address they've got, what MAC address it has. So that's just another way of getting a list of all the IP addresses that are dished out on your network without going onto the Windows server to have a look. And of course, if you're on a home computer, on a home network, and you haven't got a Windows server to look at, that's just another way of doing it. Have you used that kind of program before, or do you just tend to use the Windows one in there?
No, I use that. I use Angry IP Scan.
Oh, I heard of that as well. Yes, yeah, same sort of thing.
But the problem you've got that some of the antivirus softwares don't like it. It just blocks it,
right?
Because it thinks it's a hacking tool.
It thinks it's trying to attack.
Yeah.
There's quite a few tools like that, isn't there? That to us as a tech, it's an actual tool which is going to help us, but you know, an antivirus or a firewall thinks it's a hacker, so you've got to remember to switch some of these things off in there. So we've gone through that. So we've got I was going to say about IP pools. Have you gone through IP pools? You have, haven't you? You
can set address pools.
Yeah, address pool. Yeah, so you can set a range. So between 50 and 150, you can dish out any number you like. And then beyond that is where you can put static ones.
Normally, if it depends how you want to do it, normally you have statics outside, but I normally like to give it a reservation, then you can give it a lease, and then it's a reservation, and you can see it in the list. The one thing I'll talk about as well is obviously what happens if you need to have multiple DHCP servers. So let's say you've got a building and you've got three floors, okay, and each floor's got a separate, it's got its own little subnet. So you've got so the first floor's subnet is 192.168.1, the second floor's got 192.168.2, and the third floor's got 192.168.3, okay. So each floor's got its own little subnet, so that you can easily define which floor you're on if you see what IP address is on. Okay, so
that's right. Well, each floor could have a different department, couldn't they? There could be an accounts department on one floor, and an engineering department on another floor. So would that mean that they've got different subnet masks? Does that block access in between the two of them?
Not by default, no. So what we'd have is you'd have some sort of router for each. So you'd have each of those levels. So you'd each have a little switch on each of the levels, or a managed switch. And you'd have to have some sort of routing so that you could route between the three subnets, okay?
Okay.
It's a bit more of what I want to speak to you on this episode. But what I wanted to say is that you'd have to have you could have a DHCP server on each floor, but with the Windows DHCP is that you can have the scope. So like on my scope here, I've got 192.168.0. You could add a second scope with 192.168.1 and .2 and .3, and all those three scopes would be on that one server. What would happen then is that obviously if it's on the local subnet, so let's say my PC is 192.168.0 is the server subnet, okay. If anyone on that range, it would know that because on that local, because where that DHCP request comes from, it'd know from that local subnet, it would give it a 192.168.0 address, okay. So you wouldn't have to. So say you're on the first floor, okay, and obviously because we're saying we're divided up the network, so each little subnet, each little range, each floor has got its own little subnet, is it would go right, it would go to the default, it would do like a little scan, and it would go right on DHCP request, and obviously on that subnet there's no DHCP server, do you understand? Because obviously the DHCP server is on 192.168 network,
okay,
obviously
it's on a different
so what happens is you can put a little IP helper on the default gateway. So this is normally like a router. So what you'd have is you have like a router with like four connections on it, let's say. So you've got one which is plugged into your 192.168 network, you've got one which is plugged onto your 192.168 192.168.1 network, and then you've got 192.168.2 is plugged into one port, and then you've got 192.168.3 network. Okay, so what the router does is it basically is like a little it tells the traffic where to go. So if it receives a packet from one, so let's say you've got a piece of packet from 192.168.2 and it goes to the, it gets to the router, and it's like 192.168.2.1, okay, and it goes, right, I want to speak to 192.168.0.1, okay, the router will know how to forward that packet, so it'll forward your packet onto the 192.168.0 network. And again, if you wanted to speak to a device on the 192.168.2 network, it would come along and it would forward that packet to that network. So each of the little networks has got its own little IP address. So let's say that the first four has got the router IP address is 192.168.1.1, okay? Yeah. And on the interface, you put a little thing called IP helper address, and that basically you forward that to the our server, let's say, which let's say it's 192.168.0.10. And what that happens is that when a PC does a DHCP request, it says, right, I want a DHCP server. It obviously does a broadcast. The router picks the default, the little router picks up and goes, yep, I know about a DHCP server. I'll go away and do your request for you. That request goes to DHCP server and says, look, I'm 192.168.1. Can I have an IP address on 192.168.1? And the server will go, yep, this is my IP address. You can give it 192.168.1.2. And that goes, right, yep, got that IP address. That router then does tells that device that it can have 192.168.1.2. So that's what an IP address helper. It helps a local subnet, which might not have a DHCP server on it, get an IP address.
Okay.
Does it all make sense?
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. So that in that situation, you've got three subnets. But, I mean, that's the whole job of a router, really, isn't it? Is to route the information to where it wants to go.
Yeah, it means you haven't got to have a DHCP. No. It means you haven't got to have a DHCP server, three DHCP servers set up. It means you can have it from one location.
Okay, so physically then, at every floor, what would you have physically on every floor? Would you have a switch on every floor? Would you have a router on every floor?
Yes, you have a switch on every floor, and then that switch will have a port into the router.
Okay.
Okay. So you wouldn't have, with this way, you wouldn't have to have a DHCP server on each floor. You'd have your DHCP server in your server room, and that would dish out for each, the router would do the DHCP distributing the IP addresses for you.
Okay, now here's the thing. What if, is this the same principle? If you had, I know this is a bit of a bigger scale, but if you had floor one had 254 devices on it, as that's the limit for one DHCP server is 254, isn't it?
Well, it depends what your subnet mask is.
Oh, okay, yes, of course. Yeah. So, okay, so I mean that was just digressing onto something else. So, so okay. So that's the next.
Yeah. So that's basically
that step done. So we're, you know, it's what you do if you want to include. Yeah. Okay.
So that's this way of having, so you can cut down into DHCP servers, because you don't want to have a server on each floor doing a DHCP, do you? You want to have one centralized place where all your DHCP servers are. So you've got one server doing a DHCP. You can then obviously go off and go to one place and look for it if you need to renew it, delete one or something. I had a bit of a fun job the other day with a missing DHCP server. We're taking over a new customer and they've got a really big Cisco setup, but no one really knows how it all hangs together, and really they don't need all this setup. But their wireless, the people on their wireless network weren't getting IP addresses anymore. So it was odd that, obviously, when their people's releases were expiring, it was disappear. They weren't obviously getting new IP addresses because the DHCP server had disappeared. So I looked on the Cisco switch to see what the IP helper was, and it was pointing to a IP address what hadn't existed. So it took me a bit of time to kind of get the, because to look around, seeing where, and no one knew where this IP address was, and their normal domain controller had all the scopes on it except for this IP address range for this wireless, and it turned out to be an old Windows 2000 server, which was sitting in the corner, which had fallen over, and
so what was that still doing there?
The DHCP.
Right.
So obviously someone noticed when they hadn't decommissioned it properly. It was their old phone server, it was old Cisco server, and someone hadn't. I've actually found it when I actually did my site survey, and I thought it was just doing the, someone hadn't bothered turning it off after decommissioning the phone system, because they're running a Nortel phone system, they're not running a Cisco phone system, so no one had bothered to decommission the server. So I'm actually doing a project at the moment to migrate that to the new server. So we need to obviously we want to decommission that server, so I've got to migrate that DHCP server from the old server to the new server. So that will be a fun project. So what I'm going to do for that is I'm going to recreate the DHCP server, or that DHCP scope on their existing domain controller, set all the same settings, and I'm going to release, and I'm going to drop the release down to 8 hours, so that over the weekend what will happen is that I'll reconfigure the IP helper on the switch to point to the new domain controller and not the old IP address, so that everyone on the who gets an IP address on the Friday will obviously that IP address will run out before Monday morning. So at the end of the day on Friday I'll swap that over, and then everyone coming on Monday, obviously their IP address will obviously be their release will be expired, and obviously you have to get a new IP address, so it will go along and get a new IP address.
Well, that sounds fun. So that's something that one of the problems that you come across, isn't it, when you take on a new customer, new clients, and a new system, that you find things like this, and you think, what is this? Where is this? Is that something you used that angry IP scanner to find, or is it,
yes?
How did you find that eventually? Was that with one of those tools?
Luckily, I did a physical site survey, and I recorded all of the device names or whatever. But because we didn't have a username and password to get onto those servers at the time, we then had we basically did a rack diagram of all the machines in the rack, and because these were old servers, no one knew what the password was, because it's had such a high turnover IT staff, and they were losing the IT company who was looking after it. I had a comms call with the people who look after it, and he goes, yeah, we dial into this server, this IP address to get onto the old Windows 2000 server. So I had to get I've written this down, and because whenever I do anything like that, I always put it into an IP spreadsheet, so we call it and all our information gets put into that one spreadsheet. And once I found out what the IP address of that DHCP was, I looked at my IP address and I matched it up, and I said, oh, this is the, I think it's like 172.16.100.14. So hang on a minute, I can't ping this anymore. And I knew that I've been on that server before when I did a bit of, when the guy told me about it. So then I had to get the customer on site to plug a monitor into all these four devices, these old Cisco servers, and one of them had blue screened. So I got them to reboot that server, just doing a hard boot, hard power off.
Yeah.
And it came back on, and I could get onto that machine. Obviously, then all the people could get their IP addresses again.
These are some of the crazy things that you come across, isn't it?
Yeah, there was no documentation. The current IT guys know nothing of how the network's set up, and that's obviously why we're important to have a look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone to places where you know, you wander around for ages and you're trying to find what there is, and you look at a cupboard and there's a little box with a light on it with a cable plugged in, and you're thinking, what the hell's this for, you know? And maybe you sort of disregarded it at the time, but you come back to it later thinking, you know, this is doing a job, or it is, you know, maybe there's a DHCP server inside this little box here, yeah, in the cupboard, you know.
How do we know?
You don't know just how do you by know looking that? At it, you know. That's one of these things with computers, physical computers, you don't know what they do just by looking at them. You have to get into the settings, and then, as in your case, you have to have access to the, you know, username and passwords to get into these things so you can find this information out. And if you haven't got that information, then you just, it's a little bit blind, isn't it, really, in a way? You're just yes, stuck without it, you know. So yeah, well, that's a lot of information about DHCP. Who knew it was so complicated? Most of us out there probably, and I remember thinking years ago, well, all it does is give out a number, you know, it just gives you out a number, or your number 1.2, and that's it, that's all it does, it dishes out numbers. But there's a lot more to it, isn't there, than just giving out numbers and things like that.
Yeah, I mean,
so what we've covered so far, is anything you haven't sort of touched on yet, or
yeah, teasing I want to say, really, DHCP is really good. I mean, you don't want to set static IP address anymore, because like, if you set a laptop with a static IP address, every time you go to, like, if you go like me, go to do customer site, you have to manually change it every time you go. So that's one reason. The other thing is, as well, good using DHCP is that if you've got sites with multiple offices, so say you've got multiple branch offices, if you ever need to change IP addresses remotely, it's so much easier. You could, obviously, you can change in the DHCP scope on the server, so you haven't physically got to go to the server. One of my first companies we used to work for, we always used to statically set every single device. So every device would have a static IP address. Before I knew, really knew about DHCP address, how good DHCP was. Because let's say if you wanted to change, so let's say you said, like, you were going on about the 254 or whatever. Let's say, like, you had 250 devices in your network, and you wanted to add more in it, and you wanted to, and the quick and easy way is that you wanted to change the subnet mask. You'd have to, so there you want to give it a bigger subnet mask, like 255.255.240, which basically gives you two lots of subnets, so two lots of 255 subnets. You'd have to go around every single device and reconfigure it, whereas with DHCP, yeah, things, all you go is, so you go in there and change the option, and then when it goes to renew its IP address, it gets those new options. So it's well, yeah, worth using DHCP.
So doing static for one or two things on a very small network is not that big a deal to change if you had to.
No.
But when you've got hundreds, you know, and especially if you're remote and you haven't got access to all these machines or mobile phones and things like that.
Yeah.
It'd just be a nightmare to change everything manually, wouldn't it? So.
Yeah. I mean, have you tried setting a static IP address on a mobile phone lately?
Well, you can somewhere.
Yeah,
I remember trying to do that for one reason. I can't remember why, but okay. So there's DHCP. So was there anything else, or was that the last bit that you've got there?
That's the last bit for me.
Okay, well, that's great. So next episode we'll be on to something else. Any ideas what that will be at this point? Or we still got to figure that out.
We've got to figure that out, yeah.
Yeah. Where do we go from that? You know, we could go on to many topics from that one subject there. So there we go for episode 2. So we hope you've enjoyed that, and we should have many more podcasts to come. So on that note, it's goodbye from me.
Yeah, and before we say goodbye, I guess if you want to get in contact with us, really, you can email us at mail@admin.adminpodcast.co.uk, or you can email me, Al, that's al@admin.adminpodcast.co.uk, or if you want to email Andy, you can email andy@admin.adminpodcast.co.uk. If you've got any feedback or any topics you want us to cover, or any questions you would like us to answer, drop us a line. So that's definitely it from me. So until next time, we'll speak soon.
I'll see you soon. Bye now.